Welcome to Proclaiming Christ, where we seek to encourage and stimulate preachers, teachers, and students of the Bible in their desire to see Christ preached and taught in all of Scripture. This is episode number 78. My name is Mark Winder, pastor of Wolf River Presbyterian Church in Collierville, Tennessee, just east of Memphis. And we have an episode in Genesis today, Genesis chapter 25, verses 1 through 21, as we look at an epilogue to Abraham. There's a transition in this passage from Abraham to Isaac, even getting to Jacob in this chapter. And with me today to discuss this passage is Adam York, pastor of Providence OPC in Kingwood, Texas. Hello, Adam.
Well, hello there, my friend. How are you doing today?
Very good, and I'm very glad that you are here. Adam is our technical expert, so every time we have a problem, Adam comes to the rescue, as he did just before we started recording this episode, so you can thank Adam for the fact that we're able to record at all. I'd be staring at the screen clueless if it wasn't for Adam rescuing us in our various technical snafus. So thank you, Adam.
We hope it all keeps working.
Right. I appreciate it. And Jim Cassidy is also here from South Austin Presbyterian Church. Hello, Jim.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Very good. I'm glad you could be with us today. We actually had visitors at our church here at Wolf River in Collierville. We had visitors on Sunday from the Austin area who are listeners to Proclaiming Christ, and was encouraged to see folks who listen to the podcast come and visit our church. And you're all, of course, invited to do that. We would love to have you come and visit one of our churches. Today we look at Genesis chapter 25, but before we do that, let me mention to you something that if you're a listener to Christ the Center, certainly you know already about this, the 2019 Theology Conference. The law is spiritual, the goal of God's law from creation to consummation. You talk about a wonderful and wide topic, one that is in need of clarity today, and certainly the speakers that will be there, Lane Tipton, Glenn Clary, who I call Glenn Clarity because he is so helpful and clear in what he presents. We'll be speaking there October 11 through 13 at the usual place, Grays Lake, Illinois. So I hope you can make it. You can go on to reformforum.org and see that at the moment that I'm speaking, at least it's at the head, the banner over the top of the webpage. If it's not there, when you go on, look under events, and at the very top, you'll find their 2019 Theology Conference. Click on register, and we hope to see you there. Today we look at Genesis chapter 5, verses 1 through 21, and it's a transition chapter in many respects. A lot happens in this chapter. It's the close of a biography, the close of one and the start of another, two others, actually, the close of the biography for Abraham and the introduction to his sons who will succeed him in the covenant line. I don't know about you guys. What's your favorite kind of reading to do?
A little bit of everything. I guess I end up doing a little more nonfiction reading than perhaps most do, but that's the nature of the pastorate.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I mean, I tend biography, nonfiction, and stories and novels is something I desire to, but find myself with very little opportunity.
Sure. I remember talking with you about that a couple of years ago. I thought, Jim, you were just going to say, all I read is systematic theology. That's all
well,
I read.
Well, it seems like that's about all I get a chance to read. Yeah.
Once you memorized Burkhoff's systematic, then you move on to other genres. But
he only reads Karl Barth.
That's it. Yeah.
Just Barth. I was hoping somebody would say biography. That's my favorite literary genre. I just enjoy reading the stories of people. And one thing that all biographies have in common, or most of them anyway, good biographies, and in my opinion, the best biographies are typically not autobiographies, but biographies written sometime after the death of the subject. And in the end, the subject of the story, of course, then always dies. And when you read a biography of an unbeliever, one of the best biographies that I've ever read, at least well-written biographies, was a biography of Charles Darwin, of all people. It was a sympathetic biography. It was very, very well-written. But when somebody like that dies, it's sad. And it's not a happy goodbye when you close the book on a biography. But another biography I thoroughly enjoyed reading was that of Herman Bavinck that I read recently. can't remember who wrote that. It's sitting there on my shelf, but I can't see the guy who wrote it. Somebody I think we all know. It was fairly recently published. But at any rate, in the end, in the case of a Christian biography, it's still sad to say goodbye, but there's a note of triumph to it. The last words are usually words of hope. Their life goes on. They won't face a second death. And today we come to the end of the biography of Abraham. And we've gotten to know Abraham pretty well. We were introduced to him in chapter 12. The majority of the book of Genesis, or at least he covers more real estate in the book of Genesis than nearly anybody else. And we've seen both spiritual triumph and tragedy. But by the time we've come to Abraham's mature years, we see that he is a man of faith. Here's a man who demonstrates a resolute trust in God, in his covenant promises, in his sovereignty, even in the power of the resurrection itself. This is a wonderful biography. And chapter 25 is setting the stage for the end of Abraham and the beginning of a new section in the history of what would become Israel. And you may remember we noted all the way back in chapter 5 that there's a key phrase that you see 11 times in the book of Genesis. These are the generations of, and that marks off significant segments of Revelation, sections of the book. And that phrase is used twice in this chapter, and it marks off the generations of Ishmael and the generations of Isaac. And that is very significant because the whole theme of this chapter, and as you go through these narrative sections and you're preaching through narratives, Adam and I were talking a little bit before the podcast about chapter 24, and you can go back and listen to that podcast, but it's hard to divide a chapter like chapter 24 into different sections. You want to take it in one fell swoop. And when you look at a chapter, a narrative chapter, typically you're looking for the theme, the overall theme. Now, this is a chapter that has a large cast of characters. What's the theme that marks this chapter? It's the conflict between the godly and the ungodly line. You see it in the generations of Ishmael, the generations of Isaac, and then it concludes with the interaction between Jacob and Esau and the selling of the birthright for a bowl of stew. So let's go ahead and look at this chapter and how it begins. And it immediately begins with a genealogical reference to Abraham's children by another wife, Keturah. So here's a chapter that in the epilogue to Abraham right away is starting off with, here is one line, and then we will see a different line as well. And verse 1 tells us Abraham took another wife, Keturah. We don't know when he marries Keturah. Is this another picture of polygamy? It's possible that it is, but what we do know is that she bears 6 children. And they're named in verse 2, Zimran, Yokshan, Midian, Yishbak, and Shuach. And we don't know exactly who these names represent, who the descendants are, but we know something about the last 3 names, Midian, Yishbak, and Shuach. And of course, Midian are the Midianites. And right away, that ought to ring a bell for us. If we know some of our Old Testament history, they eventually occupy part of the Arabian Peninsula, and they become a collection of tribes scattered close to the borders of Egypt and Israel. Moses' wife, as you probably know, comes from the Midianites. And we know a little bit about Yishbak from extra-biblical literature. Shuach fathers another tribe of people who settle around the middle of the Euphrates River. You read a little bit about that, Job chapter 2. We read about Bildad, the Shuhite. And then in verses 3 and 4, we read about the descendants of some of these 6 children. The sons of Yokshan lead to the founding of some well-known cities that were prominent in the area. They trade in spices, particularly Keturah's name means spice or incense. And the sons of Keturah's son Midian are mentioned in verse 4. Those names are probably tribes that made up the Midianites. Now, all of these descendants are named in these first 4 verses. And we have to ask why, especially because we don't know who they are today. And again, it's to create that contrast. This all fits within the theme of the book. These are the descendants of Abraham's concubine, but they're not descendants of promise. And this contrast then is brought out in verses 5 and 6 and really throughout the rest of the chapter. Isaac has many brothers and presumably sisters, but Isaac stands out from among those brothers. And in verse 5, that comes out.
Well, I'm just noticing how I was, when I was going through this, noticing the challenge of this passage in terms of where it comes. I mean, all of a sudden, it's interesting, Abraham starts having all these children, you know, whereas he was complaining previously, you know, that he was 100 and he couldn't have children. Now, if you follow the narrative in the text, he's probably something like 140. I was just noting how various commentators, no less than Calvin, even argue that chapter 25 may have, you know, maybe not in strict chronological order, maybe the reason for placing it here, if that is the case, is that it's kind of an unspoken element of condemnation towards Abram. Hmm. The way that, in the same way that he took Hagar as a concubine, even some would perhaps say that maybe even while Sarah was alive, he had Keturah. So right. I don't know if that's one, even in my sermon, I put, you know, I'm not going to try to settle the question, but it's that's a challenging part of the narrative. All of a sudden does he start having all these children where he has none previously?
Right. There's a hint, a suggestion of polygamy, but the time is undefined and they may well be right. That is a bit of a struggle to try to figure that out. The first four verses may well be something that takes place long before verse 5, where Abraham gives all that he has to Isaac. So we just don't know. It seems to make sense that it may be polygamous, because even though it was clear that that shouldn't be practiced, it was typical of the culture, and Abraham's already demonstrated his willingness to engage in that. But it also is setting up a contrast between the godly and the ungodly line. And where does this other line come from? Well, Keturah, the concubine, and Ishmael. But there's one chosen, and that's Isaac. So it could be.
Sorry to interrupt. I'll let you pick back up.
No, that's an excellent observation to make. And there are some times when you come to text, you just don't know. And I think what you do in the sermon is very good. You don't try to settle those questions. They can't be settled. You can turn it maybe into an interesting Sunday school class for a portion of time. But in a sermon, it's really not germane to the text, but it's worth noting.
Right.
But in the end, Abraham gives everything he has to Isaac, verse 5, but to. So here's again the contrast, the antithesis between these two seeds or these two offspring. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, verse 6, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. So there's very clear contrast between Isaac and these other children. Isaac's designated, he is the sole heir of all that Abraham possesses. And under ancient Near Eastern custom or even law, if Abraham hasn't designated the children of his concubine to be his children, then those children of the slave or the concubine would get no inheritance at all. And you may remember the importance of that back when we looked at Ishmael. He's sent away. He's not declared officially to be the son of Abraham. He's disinherited. And that might seem like a tremendous insult, but it was pretty typical. And in fact, Abraham's bestowal of gifts on them is quite generous. He had no obligation to do that. None of these are of the promised line. None of them will inherit the promises. That's exclusively for the promised offspring and his descendants. But Abraham still gives gifts to these other children. And perhaps there's an echo here, I think, of the fact that God gives gifts even to those who are not of the offspring of the woman. You look at Cain. Cain has the ability to set up a culture. You look at the promises given to Hagar and Ishmael. You look at the provisions made after the flood, the way that God is gracious to all in terms of his giving gifts, the rain that falls on the just and on the unjust. But they're not saving gifts. Now, they're not redemptive gifts.
Absolutely.
And then in verse 6, while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the east country. The law of the ancient Near East indicated that the right of inheritance had to be designated while the father was still living. And so while Abraham's still living, he sends them away from Isaac so they'd pose no threat to them. They go to the east where and again, Keturah's name, spices, attests to this. They established trade routes in the East. We know this from history and from biblical history, and they dealt in a variety of spices and so on, and trade was established over the years because of that. And then that last matter now being taken care of, we read of the end of Abraham. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years, verse 7. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Now, the way this is written is important because the expression gathered to his people is an expression that's reserved for important figures in the Pentateuch, figures like Ishmael, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, and it meant more than simply he was buried in a tomb or in a gravesite along with his forefathers, and we know that's not the case with Abraham. He wasn't literally gathered back to his homeland out of Mesopotamia. We know he's buried in the cave at Machpelah, and it's not even talking about his burial because that's addressed in verse 9. It's probably making a recognition here, a general recognition of the afterlife. We've talked before about the fact that Abraham believed in a resurrection. That's clear. It's clear in other books of the Bible as well, in the Old Testament, the book of Job, for example. Job believes in the idea of a resurrection, that in my flesh I will see God, though his flesh is decaying and will go to the grave. It will return to the dust, but his flesh, his eyes will see the resurrected one. And so there's a belief here, and this is probably a general recognition of the afterlife. This is probably more of an idiom than it is a doctrinal teaching on the resurrection, because we see that the same phrase is used of Ishmael gathered to his people. But there's still this understanding that although Abraham breathes his last and dies, that there is more.
You know, Mark, I know what you're talking about there about being gathered and the hope of resurrection. I concur with that. And also, it's very interesting that the ESV translates verse 8, I think, died full of years. In Hebrew, the of years doesn't really occur. It's just literally Abraham died full. And maybe that's perhaps the better translation to go with. It's very interesting that Abraham dies full. He dies satisfied. He does not yet possess any of the land God promised him, but he dies in fullness. You know, how can that be? That's because, again, he's trusting and relying on God's promises. He's walking by faith and not by sight, even though he does not yet enjoy those things. He doesn't possess them by sight. He does by faith. I don't think that's too much of a stretch to see the satisfaction and the fullness that he dies with, content in God's promises. And that's just something to think of in terms of the language of that.
That's great. Thank you. Good point. So after we read that Abraham dies, then verse 9 introduces us to Isaac and Ishmael, his sons. And notice whose name is mentioned in verse 9. It's Isaac, the child of promise, not the firstborn, but the child of promise. And they bury him in the cave at Machpelah. And that ends the story of Abraham. And verse 11, I think, provides an epilogue to his life. After the death of Abraham, God blessed his son, Isaac. And that's a beautiful verse as an epilogue, because remember, the covenant promise to Abraham is not just to Abraham, but Abraham and his offspring after him to 1,000 generations. And there's something particular about this blessing that the narrator wants us to understand even before he moves on to the next section. We read that Isaac settled at Beer Lahai Roi. And you'll remember that this is the name of the place to which Hagar fled when she was pregnant with Ishmael. And God tells her that his hand shall be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And the fact that Isaac now makes this very place his home is pointing to the fact that he has dominance over Ishmael. And it continues this story of conflict between the offspring of the woman and the offspring of the serpent. So we've read about the descendants of Abraham through Keturah, and now we read the generations of Ishmael in the next section. And this is the end of the story of Abraham's life. And now it moves on to look at Ishmael, and it's a separate section. It's marked off by another one of these phrases. We see almost a dozen of them in Genesis, Ele, Toadot. These are the generations of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. And again, notice right away this seed of the woman, seed of the serpent, antithesis. This is Hagar, the Egyptian, the servant, Ishmael. And there's a lot of echoes in Ishmael's genealogy of the promise that God made to his mother Hagar in Genesis 16 and 17. The very mention of her name, even, we might call it an honorable mention. Now it's tied together with the fact that she's an Egyptian, but God keeps his promise that Ishmael's line would continue. And verses 13 through 15 names the sons. We see in verse 16, they're named by 12 tribes that descend from the sons. And that ought to ring a bell right away to us, because it's setting up, again, a contrast between the sons of Israel and the later development of the 12 tribes. And we don't know where many of these tribes settled or who many of these people are, but we know some of them, but not all of them. But we do know that a contrast is being set up. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, verse 17, 137 years, notably less than Abraham. He breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. Now, again, that's the same words used to describe Abraham's death. One of the reasons we know it's not a theology of eternal life, it's applied to Ishmael here. But once again, Ishmael's given a place of honor. He is spoken of in the same terms that Abraham is spoken of, not quite the same terms, but using some of the same terms. And his lineage settles, verse 18, in Kavala to Shur, which is opposite of Egypt in the direction of Assyria. That's about as specific as it gets. We don't know exactly where Kavala and Shur were, somewhere between Egypt and Assyria. That's all we know. So he settled, but here's the key. He settled over against all his kinsmen. Now that's exactly what God had promised at Beer Lahai Roi when he spoke to Hagar. So there's this theme of contrast. And what's going to happen now is that this theme of contrast is going to continue to the next section, which is the story of Esau and Jacob, another section marked off by that now familiar phrase, Ele Toadot. These are the generations of. But we can see here clearly that both the blessings and the cursings that belong to Ishmael, just as God had promised Hagar, there's no promised land for Ishmael. He will occupy a place, but he will do so as a wanderer, as a people in constant conflict throughout history. The descendants of Ishmael will continue to struggle against the descendants of Isaac, 12 tribes against 12 tribes. And there's significance in that, I think, the naming of these 12. There are a number of times in Genesis that 12 tribes are mentioned. It's not just of the Israelites, but of the Ishmaelites, the Edomites, and others. And if you think about that number throughout the Bible, it's a very prominent number, and it seems to suggest the way in which God orders his creation. In fact, if you think about Revelation, think about chapter 7, the 12 times 12, the 144,000, they represent the totality of the church of Jesus Christ. It's representative of God's work of redemption, reaching its completion and the salvation of the whole number of the elect. God's work come to fruition, his work come to fulfillment. So it's a reminder of the fact, and we need to keep this in mind when we look at the genealogies. I think we discussed this when we were in chapter 5 to some extent, that when you're reading these genealogies, this is not a table that lists every single descendant of whoever the patriarch is, Ishmael, in this case. These are not datable chronological tables by which you may, for example, deduce the age of the earth or something like that. These are pictures. These are representative numbers and people. The number 12, and we see this, of course, in the genealogies of the New Testament as well. The line of Ishmael, as well as the descendants of Keturah, are not children of promise, but from the nations which proceed from them, here's the key. There would be many who would come to the tent of Isaac. There would be many who would come into the promised line, but they would need to do so through the promised one, through the promised offspring. There will be many in the 12 times 12, the 12 apostles, 12 tribes, the 144,000 in Revelation. There will be many from the 12 of Ishmael who come into the 12, as it were, of Israel. The nations would come. And as we look at the end of Abraham's life and at the end of Ishmael's life, we see a people who are still given some measure of temporary blessing, but they'll face the judgment of God for their unbelief, and God will use them to judge the Israelites for their sins later on, but because of their disobedience, God would judge them as well. The prophets deliver oracles of judgment against some of these very descendants. Isaiah does, Jeremiah does. But because of the promise made to Abraham, it's going to be confirmed to Isaac. God will take some of these very descendants and transform them into spiritual descendants of Abraham. There are many Ishmaelites who will become true Israelites. There are many Keturahites, if you will become true Israelites. The prophet Amos speaks of the fact that even among the Gentiles, there's a remnant who is called by the name of the Lord. And that phrase, a people called by God's name, that's a phrase in the Old Testament that's used almost exclusively to speak of Israel. Only the Israelites are called by God's name. But Amos says, among the Gentiles, there are those who will be called by the name of the Lord. And the prophets anticipate that among those called by God's name would be some of these descendants. There's tremendous hope even in this passage. The gospel is in this passage. Acts 15 takes up the message of the prophet Amos and speaks of the remnant of mankind and the Gentiles who are called by my name. So even at the dawn of the shaping of the Israelites, you have the message of redemption.
Yes, it's very interesting. And there seems to be a canonical awareness of the structural importance of what's going on here in chapter 25. Maybe you're planning on mentioning this, but there's a connection with this passage and Isaiah 60. And Isaiah 60 really looks forward to a time when the Gentiles, all of the nations even, will return to the promised land. And there are some notable figures in verse 6 of chapter 60 mentions Midian, of course, as we've seen, a son of Keturah,
right.
And Sheba, a son of Keturah. And then verse 7, Kedar and Nebaioth, sons of Ishmael.
Right.
And so for the first time since Genesis 25, we're seeing all of these names mentioned again. And
exactly.
Yeah, the nations are bringing their wealth as tribute to the Lord, as it will be in the new covenant.
Exactly, right. That hits the nail. It's exactly what's going on. Every tongue, tribe, language, and nation. The prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, they recognize this. And this is, brothers and sisters, this is why we interpret the Bible covenantally. Mm-hmm. We take a look at these names and where are they found? What's the prophecy? How are they used? What hope is there in what we are reading? Where's the message of redemption? Even in this passage, which doesn't really have a whole lot, if that's all you're concentrating on is Genesis chapter 25, but you go to the prophets, Isaiah 60, Jeremiah, the book of Revelation, the anticipation of the Gentiles, even from the mention to Abraham that in you all the nations will be blessed. There's
yeah.
tremendous hope of redemption.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing, Mark. And you really bring up a good point here in terms of how pastorally we are dealing with texts in our preaching ministry. And of course, this is a very appropriate thing to bring up in the context of this show, where we're not only doing Christ-centered exposition, but also talking about principles of homiletics and hermeneutics and where those two, homiletics and hermeneutics, kind of converge. And you really put your finger on it in a beautiful way as we understand the scriptures covenantally. And I think there's a temptation, is maybe a commentary broadly, moving outside of your passage, if you don't mind, but there is a tendency among expositors to sort of focus atomistically on on the text that you're dealing with. And then it becomes sort of a verse-by-verse commentary on what the text before you says, which is fine. But if it stays there and then you decide, all right, now I got to, from those expositions of those particular verses alone, then I think we end up really losing the real meaning of the text, which can only be understood in its covenantal development as it moves towards Christ, as you've done here in a beautiful way, especially connecting this passage to the prophets, and as the prophet, the eschatological fulfillment in Christ, you know, Acts 15 and other passages which talk about the remnant of the Gentile, of Israel and the Gentiles, Romans 9 through 11. I mean, it's so rich. You can't just stay in your text. You have to read the text in its more broadly covenantal setting.
Yes. Amen, brother. If expository preaching to you is just giving the meanings of the words in the particular passage in front of you and not relating it to the broader context of redemptive history, you haven't done justice to that passage. The Old Testament is screaming out, or I think as Lame Tipton puts it, it is demanding to be fulfilled. And we have to see how that fulfillment takes place. And it's even from the beginning, right? You see it in the book of Exodus. You will be to me a special people from all the nations. And we're seeing that development here. And of course, how do all these things come to pass? The promise in Exodus, the promise in the prophets, is the people of God will be made up from all the nations. How? Well, it's through the offspring of Abraham, Jesus Christ, through the seed of the woman. So Paul tells us those who are of the household of Abraham, those who are of faith, it isn't the children of the flesh who are the children of God, but the children of promise are counted as offspring. And this is also, by the way, a way in which we recognize who are these children of promise. Who are those who are the true seat of Abraham? Acts 15, you know, you mentioned, Jim, a fantastic passage where James says that the tent of Abraham, the tabernacle of Abraham, will be raised up again, just like Amos said. And this would be fulfilled in the church because Christ is the true tabernacle of David, who holds the key of the house of David in his hands, just like he wrote to the church in Philadelphia, I have the key of David. It's Christ who will open the door to these nations, that they can come in and worship him. And isn't that a fulfillment of the covenant with Noah, that the descendants of Japheth will come to the tent of Shem? So it's throughout the fabric, it's woven throughout the fabric of all of Scripture, this concept of the nations coming, the true Israel of God, the one who will triumph over these nations, the one who will, as Isaiah tells us, 42, cause many of them to sing for joy when they come to the salvation of the promised one, the one who's defeated the great deceiver of the nations, whose gospel is spread all over the globe. That's the Great Commission. Take the gospel and spread it all over the globe. And he invites the nations. Jesus invites the nations. We invite the nations as we preach. Brothers, as you preach this text, as you teach this text, this is the message of Christ to the nations, to your congregation, to invite you and me and all who are weary and heavy laden, to give rest for your souls. So when we come to the end of our lives, as we come to the end of theirs here in the text, right? Abraham, Keturah, Ishmael, all three of these names are seen again in the Bible. All three of them point us to the Redeemer. Well, thank you for listening to Proclaiming Christ. We appreciate you taking the time to do that. Now, in the next podcast, we're going to move on, and we're going to look at now another theme of conflict, and that's of Esau and Jacob. Let's set that up right now just a little bit, because right after verse 18, we have a concern. Rebekah has a grave concern in chapter 25, and God takes the occasion of her concern and directs it to eternity. And he's revealing his plan for redemptive history. And again, we're going to see a separate section marked off by the listing of Isaac's age, verse 40 at the beginning, and listing his age again, verse 60. Or I'm sorry, age 60 at the end of this section. That's in verse 26. And this is setting the stage for the next segment, verses 27 to 34, that stew and birthright episode. And there's a foreshadowing now of the struggle now between Jacob and Esau, in the prophecy that God's going to deliver to Rebecca. Any last comments, gentlemen?
It's beautiful material, brother. What a foreshadowing of the blessings of inheritance that we have in the gospel.
And we'll see more of that inheritance and the consequences of rejecting that inheritance in the next podcast. Most of the main material we've already covered here, this theme of contrast here, but woven in here is the grand theme of God's glorious redemption in the offspring of the woman, Jesus Christ. Adam, thanks for joining us today. Adam's the pastor of Providence OPC in Kingwood, Texas, and he kept things running smoothly today. If there were any technical difficulties, send Adam an email and let him know. And then Jim Cassidy also, I'm kidding about that, but Jim Cassidy is the pastor of South Austin Presbyterian Church in Austin, Texas. And
don't send me any emails.
Don't send Jim any emails. I'll send him all of your systematic theology questions. Direct those to Jim. And any compliments about the podcast, be sure to send them to me. But thank you for listening to Proclaiming Christ.